I wish Monica was here. It's been amazing. Monica's been giving me all my material for the last week. So we're gonna use a lot of Monica material. And not only that, last time we were together, Monica kind of gave us the leading question. And it was, what can we do to make 2006 better? And to me it was perfect because it's so practical. If what we do here, if what we do in prayer, if what we do in worship doesn't make 2006 better, then what are we doing it for? From a true Hebraic point of view, everything is focused on what's happening right here and right now, in this moment. If this moment is not transformed, if this moment is not full of the Spirit of God, then there's something wrong with what we're doing. You know, we have not entered the kingdom in that moment. And so I love Monica's question. What can we do to make 2006 better? And everything has got to have a rubber and road component to it. If we're just doing stuff in the abstract, if we're doing it in the academic, if we're keeping it out there in the ethereal land, and we're not bringing it down to what we do on a day-to-day basis, if it can't make the loss of a job, the loss of a relative, if it can't make the stress of finding a new house and doing your day-to-day job better, what are we doing? If our faith cannot make those details of life more livable, more enjoyable, then we have a problem. We were at another church a few weeks ago, and it was a really interesting experience because the pastor was going through kind of a laundry list of things that we should be doing. And a lot of what he was talking about was self-denial, kind of denying yourself in favor of others. He was talking about following, obviously, the law and doing what you're supposed to do. He was talking about the world as a fallen place, and we're struggling in that fallen creation, basically, trying to walk a different way. And so he's laying all this stuff out, and then he says, and you know, the trouble with Christians is they don't have a lot of joy. You know, we should be the most joyful people, the most celebratory people. And okay, let's think. Let's put this on a little mathematical equation. Self-denial plus all the don'ts in life. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. And the world is a fallen, depraved place equals joy. I agreed with all his conclusions. But the mindset, the worldview, the perspective from which we approach this whole thing doesn't equal joy. It equals resentment. It equals regret. It equals self-condemnation. It equals all sorts of things, but it doesn't equal joy. I mean, the way we approach our faith has everything to do with how we're going to act at the end of all of this. So if you look at your life, and your life is stressful, anxious, if it's full of grief or depression and all of those things, then you're basically fear-based. The basic question you can always ask yourself is, what am I afraid of in any situation that you find yourself in? What am I afraid of? Because that's going to be right at the bone, right at the nub of it all. Because if you can identify that, then you can start to work. And I think what we need to recognize, and please, let's all recognize, yes, there are things wrong in the world, but the world is a beautiful place. I mean, go outside and look around. It is gorgeous. People are good and bad and everything in between. They can act evilly, but you know what? There's potential in each one of us to be connected and one with God as we're trying to be. That potential exists. We need to see the world the way God sees it. And how does God see it? Well, Genesis tells us. He made his creation and he saw that it was very good. The Hebrew says very good. No matter what anybody tells you, the world is very good from God's perspective. All right? We may be screwing it up on a moment-by-moment basis, but it is very good. We need to see that. If we're going to be a joyful, celebratory people, we need to see first and foremost that the world is a good place and God is a good God. And those two things together give us all the hope that we need. But we've got to see through some of that stuff. One of the things that Monica sent me this month, this last week that I want to read to you, and I don't normally open my sermons with a joke, but just for Lisa's sake, I'm going to do it. Okay. Oh, yeah. You ready? Okay. The Lone Ranger and Tonto stopped in the desert for the night. After they got their tent all set up, both men fell sound asleep. Some hours later, Tonto wakes the Lone Ranger and says, "Gimel Sabe, look towards sky, what you see?" The Lone Ranger replies, "I see millions of stars." "What that tell you?" asked Tonto. The Lone Ranger ponders for a minute and then says, Astronomically speaking, it tells me there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, it tells me that Saturn is in Leo. Time-wise, it appears to be approximately 3:15 in the morning. Theologically, it's evident that the Lord is all-powerful and we are small and insignificant. Meteorologically, it seems we will have a beautiful day tomorrow. What's it tell you, Tonto? Tonto is silent for a moment and then says, Kimo sabe, you dumber than buffalo dropping. It means someone stole tent. Are you starting to see the correlation here? If what we learn in here, and what if we do in here, and everything about our faith is so intellectualized, it is so cognitive, abstract, so heady, that we can't even see that the tent is gone, we got a problem here. We've got to keep our faith practical. And that is the operative word, practical. The Hebrews were a practical people. The Bible that they wrote, and make no mistake, Jews wrote the Bible. It is a practical book. Every book in the Bible exists for a practical reason. It was written by someone, for someone, that they were living with. Each one of the epistles, and I love this description of the epistles are like a Jeopardy game, where you have the answer and not the question. You get the answer, and then you say, the question is. Every one of Paul's letters, or any of the letters, are responding to some problem, some breach of conduct, something that is going on that we don't have. So what we're reading is the answers to that question. But make no mistake, it was specific to a task. The Torah, the first five books, are specific to a people. They're written for a people. Each one of the prophetic books were written to address a specific situation. It's practical. And in case practical is escaping you, let me just read some of the definitions of practical. First of all, it comes from the Greek word praktikos, which from prasein, which means to pass over, to fare, or to do. And that's a key word, to do. It is manifested in practice or action, not a theoretical or an ideal. Being such in practice or effect, as in virtual. It was a practical failure, so it is what it is, you know, practically speaking. Actively engaged in some sort of action or occupation. Capable of being put to use or account. Disposed to action as opposed to speculation or abstraction. Ooh, that's a good one, huh? Disposed to action as opposed to speculation or abstraction. Qualified by practice or practical training, as in a good practical mechanic. Designed to supplement theoretical training by experience. Concerned with voluntary action and ethical decisions. Every single one of those definitions deals with doing and not just thinking about it. It is all something that is concrete, and you can put your hands around it. It's all dealing with the stuff of life, as opposed to some theoretical sort of thing. This is what we need to do. We need to become Hebrews in that respect. You know, just as James said, faith without works is dead. The faith that is just theoretical, the faith that is just in your head, as something you agree to believe in, means nothing from a Hebrew point of view. It's what you do that is the measure of what you believe, and not what you say you believe. So our target verse today is going to be Matthew 7, 21 to 23. And why don't we go there, and actually, you guys go there. I want, Michael, go ahead and read Romans 12, 1 and 2, just as a little precursor.
I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercy of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God.
Okay. So in order to prove what is the acceptable and perfect will of God, what's the first thing you got to do? You need to renew your mind. That is the key. That before you can do anything else, you have to have the concept of what you're going for. No matter how hard you work, you want to dig up some buried treasure? You can dig all day long. You can dig for 40 years, like that movie Holes. If you don't know where to dig, it doesn't matter, does it, how hard you work? The first part is you got to renew your mind. You have to have the correct concept, perception of reality in order to move forward. That's the first step. And one of the first things that we need to get ourselves wrapped around is this idea of the concrete versus the abstract. We need to make things absolutely concrete in our lives. They need to be actually affecting our lives. Jesus is all about transformation. If that doesn't happen, what do you got? You can have all of this stuff from a religious point of view. If it doesn't transform your life, there's really nothing happening. And so Paul tells us explicitly, the first thing, and especially for us Westerners, everything has to go through the mind first. We approach things through the mind. I mean, except for my wife and some of you women who are much more intuitive, and maybe Russell, you know, he's an intuitive. They bring it in through the heart, and that informs the mind. But for most of us, it's the opposite way. It goes to the mind first, and that informs the heart. And so we need, but all of us, regardless, are going to need to have the right concept. So when we read Matthew 7:21-23, Bob, you want to do that for us?
Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name? And when I will declare to them, I never knew you, depart from me, you who practice lawlessness.
When you hear that, and this is something we talked about in the Bible study on Thursday, but it was a powerful point. When you hear that, what's the first thing that you normally think about? When is this scenario taking place, first of all? How have you heard this verse taught before? What is it pertaining to? I don't know if you've ever heard it this way, but normally the way I've heard it is it's pointing to the final judgment. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah.
Okay, so the whole context from the typical Christian interpretation is that this verse is taking place at the final judgment, when the Lord is separating the sheep and the goats. And here are the people that are going to come to Him thinking that they got it all wired, and He's going to say, no, you're going to hell, you're not coming with me. One of the people in the Bible study asked the question, and she said, what if, you know, I think I'm doing everything right. What if, though, I get to that time and the Lord says, I never knew you? I mean, that broke my heart to hear that. None of that. Here's been someone who's been with us for several years working through this painfully. How many times have we tried to redefine the kingdom of God? Not as being heaven, afterlife heaven, but being the presence of God right here and right now. Being aware of the presence and power of God right here and right now. And yet, even with all of that, she still had that thought. Now think about what that does to her. If she really is wondering whether what she's doing is enough to get God's final acceptance, how miserable is that? In the same evening, one of the other guys shared with us that his son, who lives in Tucson, has been divorced for 3 years and didn't tell them. Didn't tell his mom and dad. This is his son. To the extent that he was sending Christmas cards from the two of them. And because he was so afraid, you know, that his dad was not going to accept his divorce. And finally, he finally told him after 3 years. And the first thing he said was, why didn't you tell me? He said, well, Dad, you know, you were so proud of me when we got married. And I just didn't want to disappoint you. And I didn't know what you'd say. And I didn't know what you'd think. Now, I want you to imagine what that last 3 years was like for him, living that lie, sending bogus Christmas cards and other forms of correspondence, trying to keep the facade up that he was still married, all the time fearing that his dad wouldn't accept him. And all the time not realizing that it didn't make a bit of difference to his dad in the first place. Why didn't you tell me, son? You know, of course I'm going to accept you. This is the same thing that the other woman is worried about with her heavenly father, isn't it? Is what I'm doing really enough? And the problem is that there's no way for her to ever find out. Not in this life. She's going to have to wait. How does that translate into joyful, celebratory Christians? It can't. We have got to have a different red X on the ground, on the map. We've got to be digging in a different spot. We need to understand. Renew our minds to understand what the Lord is really telling us. He can't be telling us that. There's no way. That this is not a guessing game. You know, we don't have to always wonder. You know, the salvation isn't supposed to be based on what we do anyways, right? So, you know, and here's the amazing thing. We say that, don't we? We know that our salvation is based on faith and not by works, so that none may boast. We say it, we quote it, we believe it, we say, and yet how do we live? So what do we really believe? Is it what we say we believe, or what we do? It's what we do. What this woman really believes is that she's saved by her works. She's saved by passing some invisible standard of God, and this verse tells her she doesn't even know what the standard is. She's trying to live by a standard that she can't even quantify. Because not only is it not saying, Lord, Lord, the next verse tells us that even doing all those great works, prophesying, doing miracles, all those great things that we would normally associate with religiosity and godliness, even that may not be enough. What in the world is going on? See, this is the problem that we have as Christians. And this is one of the reasons I think that we're not a celebratory people. We're a scared people. We're a fearful people. And why is it so hard then to make this switch? The switch is based on a worldview. This is the renewing of your mind part. You know what I mean by worldview? A worldview is everything that you understand about reality, all rolled up into a ball. Okay? Everything that you understand. You've got a personal worldview and you've got a social worldview. Your personal worldview is pretty much set by the time that you're 7 years old. Did you know that? By the time you're about seven, all of your personal worldview has been set in place by whatever combination of environmental events have taken place in your life. So, if you've been traumatized or abused as a child, that's going to be the foundation of your worldview. The things that you had to put in place in order to survive that, to move through that, are now set in your worldview. And that's why it takes decades to untie the knots that get put in. Especially for an abused person, they may never be straight. You want to know why child abuse is one of the most heinous things on the face of the earth? Because it ruins people's worldview from an early age, and it's so difficult for them to get off. It's manifested in all sorts of destructive behavior afterwards. And even if you didn't have an abusive, traumatic childhood, each one of us, as we've said here before, does not get out of childhood unscarred. Something always happens because the child is a narcissist. The child thinks the world revolves around them. Finding out the painful truth that it doesn't is a wound that goes deep. Even if you had the best possible circumstances. Oh my gosh, I am not the center of the universe. Everything is not here for my benefit. How do I deal with that? How you deal with that forms the core of your personal worldview. And it forms the core of how you're going to be making decisions in young adulthood and adulthood until you finally go back, purge all that stuff, and then you can start to make decisions based on what is. You know, the 12-step program, what's that all about? It's about going back and changing, renewing your mind and getting a worldview that centers on something else so that the addictive behavior can be dropped. It's not about just trying to stop drinking or stop using. It's about changing your worldview so that that isn't central to your life and existence anymore. We're all recovering addicts of some sort. We've got something. How do we renew our minds? How do we become transformed? This is what Jesus is getting at. It's not about saying, Lord, Lord. It's not about even doing these great things. There's something else involved. But the thing is, we also have a social worldview. All right? Now, the social worldview is even more difficult, because that's the way our whole society perceives reality. The trouble with the worldview is that you don't even see it as a worldview. It's just the way things are. It's the ground that you walk on. It's the air that you breathe. It's the foundation of everything that you see. So you don't see it as a worldview. Here we are speaking American West Coast English, right? To us, it's the way we talk. When we hear someone from the South or the East Coast, well, they've got an accent, right? But for them, we've got the accent. We don't hear our own accent because it's our accent. We don't hear it in ourselves. This goes so deep. The pre-Columbian Indians, and we've talked about this in our class as well, when Columbus came to the New World, the natives that he met had no word for past or future in their vocabulary. Think about it. They had no words for past or future in the vocabulary. There's a Payo Indian tribe in the Philippines. They have no word for thank you. The Aborigines of Australia have no word for past or future either, and all they conceive of is what they call dream time. It's a constant now, a constant is. This moment forever is dream time to the Aborigines. And my personal favorite, and Marion and I saw a special on these guys, you might have seen it too, on the Moken Sea Gypsies in the Indian Ocean. They live around the islands of Surin off the Thai coast. And these people are amazing. They can stay. They typically stay at sea up to 6 months at a time. They can see twice as far underwater than normal people can. And they can also actually decrease their heart rate in order to stay underwater for longer periods of time and dive deeper. And this is just all part of their culture because they basically live as much in the ocean or more in the ocean than they do on land. When the tsunami hit last year, not a single Moken was killed because they were so in tune with nature and their surroundings that they were able to read the sea and read what was happening. If they were on land, they had enough advance warning to seek higher ground. If they were in their boats, they had enough advance warning to seek deeper water or the tsunami wouldn't affect them, and not a single one was killed. And that's really how they came to the Westerners' attention, was through this tragedy. They have no word in their vocabulary for when. They have no word for hello or goodbye in their vocabulary. If you start to put all this together, you're talking about a people that do not have a concept of past or future. They don't have a word for it. Therefore, they don't have a word for when. They don't have birthdays. They don't grieve when someone leaves, has to go away for a period of time, and they don't celebrate when they return. The Mokans also have no word for want. So they don't have a sense of wanting, of coveting, of miserliness, of greed, of storing. The Apayos, who have no word for thank you, don't even have a sense of the gratitude of the normal exchanges in life, because it's just what they do. They're a communal, a collective type of people. This is just expected behavior. It doesn't require any special gratitude. It's what we do. When we were talking about this in class, there was a woman there who just was kind of coming unglued a little bit. She said, how can you not grieve when someone leaves? How can you not want to celebrate when they come back? How can you not celebrate? They don't celebrate birthdays. No one knows how old they are because they don't keep any records of this. It doesn't matter to them. And she just said, well, I just think that's strange. I mean, what came down to was she couldn't see how they were actually loving each other if they couldn't feel these types of emotions that we feel. And when you take that to its logical conclusion, she really couldn't see them as fully human because of that, because they couldn't love each other the way that we do. And I was trying to explain, of course they love each other just as intensely. They do it in a different way. Since they just are concentrated on the now, they're not concentrated on something that is removed for them. They are dealing with the faces that are in front of them and not the ones that are absent, until the ones that are absent become back in front of them again, and then they are just as aware and just as loving. They love each other, but not in our Western way. They love each other in their way. How foreign is that? How alien is that? How hard is that to think of not celebrating a birthday or not saying goodbye and not being excited when someone comes back? It does seem less than human, because we have our worldview. And they would be just as alienized to try to come into our worldview. Changing your worldview is the hardest thing that you will ever do. But listen, let's make no mistake. The ancient Hebrew worldview has words for past and future. They were a people that were very, very much focused on their history as a people and God's action in their lives in the past. They also looked forward to the future. They look forward to the time when the throne of David would be restored. So I don't want to, in your minds, equate the ancient Hebrews with the Mokans, but there is a common thread that is decidedly non-Western, and that is the focus on the here and now as opposed to. So what we're saying is, if your focus is always on what is abstract or absent in opposition to what is here and now, you're out of balance. Jesus was very much focused on the here and now. Not that he wasn't aware of past and future, but he was balanced. What is important, what is critical, are the eyeballs that you're looking into right now. In a very real sense, what's outside of this room does not exist for us. If a bomb went off in Houston right now, does that exist for us? until we're in that moment when we're aware of it. Now it exists for us. And so if you look at Jesus' life, his style, and his teaching, he's focused on the here and now, even though he's obviously aware. We don't have to become Easterners. We have to become balanced. And part of the balance is to understand that the priority is right here and right now. I want to give you a couple examples of how this worldview shift actually affects us in our Christian walk. The first thing is, think about our view of evangelism. Okay, we got the Great Commission. Jesus says, go out and make disciples of all the world. Think about how we actually make that happen. And the mode that we use is basically, listen to this, the mode that we use for evangelism is basically Western imperialism. Imperialism has to do with forming empires, establishing empires. Here's our legacy from the Romans, all right? We're going to and the Greeks. We're going to establish an empire. Now think about the imagery we use. We're going to put on the armor of God. We're going to go out as warriors for Christ, and we're going to take the land. Isn't that the basic imagery that we always hear? That kind of imagery is really very foreign to what Jesus was talking about. You know, if our basic image is the warrior, Jesus' basic image was the gardener or the farmer. Someone who works quietly, step by step, within the movings and comings and goings of nature, within the rhythms of nature. You know, planting, tending, nurturing, seeing things come to fruition. And now think about Jesus' life. That's the way he lived. He didn't move into an area and demand attention and take the land for Christ, for himself. What he did was he went in and he planted seeds. And he watched them grow and he nurtured the people with whom they were growing. And then wait and see if there was any fruit. A very different type of imagery. Now we can say what, you know, Ephesians 6, 11 to 17, that's the whole put on the full armor of Christ. What is the question to the answer that Paul is giving in Ephesians? He tells them to put on the full armor of Christ. He tells them to be vigilant and to fight. But that is an answer to a question. The question is that at the time that Ephesians was written and in the time that 1 Corinthians was written, if you remember in 1 Corinthians, he talks about this present crisis or this present distress. You have to know what the present distress or crisis was. Paul is writing between 55 and 64 or so AD. That is during the reign of Emperor Nero. Nero was the first emperor to persecute Christians. If you are dealing with a church that is facing persecution, you're going to have to deal with your environment differently than a church that is not facing persecution. You're going to have to see yourself as putting on armor and going out as a warrior when someone is trying to kill you, when someone is trying to find out who you are. So when in 1 Corinthians, Paul says, because of this present crisis, it's better not to marry. Just stay like I am. Just sit tight and hang out. You know, the Lord's coming soon, and you have a different mentality than if it's open-ended, if you don't have the persecution on top of you. And so the warrior image makes sense within a certain context. Does that mean now that we should generalize it and make the warrior the main image for the way we live? If we're trying to get from fear to love, think about the wife of the warrior. The warrior is always on guard. The warrior is always looking behind every tree. The warrior is looking for the next threat. The warrior lives in a state of anxiety on the battlefield by necessity. If that's the way that we're supposed to live our entire lives, well, then that's going to be the fruit of that. And how do we get to joy? So these are the things we need to think about as far as that's concerned. Now think about the church and the church hierarchy. How do we deal with that in terms of our worldview? Well, basically, if you think about the way churches are run today, they're run in terms of Western capitalism, aren't they? You know, you have the whole thing where you've got a CEO, you've got a board of directors, you've got a senior pastor, you've got the board-run church, you've got marketing techniques that you use. The whole basis of the church is to grow, almost like a virus, to grow and to spawn more things and to continue to grow. Bigger is always better. If there's no growth, if the church hasn't grown, then it is seen as unsuccessful. And that's very, very capitalistic thinking. If there isn't growth, if there isn't, you know, and the bigger the church, the more successful it is, the more blessed by God it is, and all the things that go along with that. You know, that's the way we think. That's the way that our thinking has reflected in the way that the church operates and the way that we operate. Is this the way Jesus was trying to teach us how to live and how to operate? And that's the question that we have to answer. So, another article that Monica sent us was about Christian debating teams. Jerry Falwell and Liberty University, they are creating these top-notch debating teams. And in fact, Liberty University is ranked number one in the country right now over like a Harvard, which is 14th. And they're arguing and learning how to argue. And the whole idea is that what they want to do is to infiltrate. They're creating lawyers and politicians who will then move into the infrastructure for Christ. Then you've got another group that we talked about, the Christian Exodus group. This is a group that is getting as many Christians as they possibly can. They've got a website, and they're all moving to North Carolina. And the idea is they want to get enough Christians in North Carolina that they can tip all of the elections in North Carolina and elect only people that are acceptable to them in terms of their moral ideas and how they want to live. These are all attempts for us to live our Christian faith. Our question is, how do we live so that God knows us? Lord, Lord, I never knew you. But Lord, I did all these things in your name. I never knew you. Knowing has a specific context in Hebrew as well. The word yada or yida in Aramaic means, it comes from a root that means hand. And so the idea is, if you are able to handle something, you know it. It's not just knowing in terms of your mind, but actually being able to handle it. You know, when Grendel or I pick up a guitar, we know it. I don't even have to pick it up and I can feel it in my hands. Because after 30 years, I know what it feels like. When I pick it up by the neck, my hands automatically go into a chord shape because I know that thing. Think about the things that you are practiced at. My sister types unbelievable words per minute. When she puts her hands on the keyboard, they automatically go right to the keys. She knows where the keys are. She doesn't have to look. Those of you who might be carpenters or surfers, those things that are under your fingers, that just your hand just goes there, that's knowing in the Hebrew sense. It's deeper than that, too, because knowing in the Hebrew can also mean familiarity, be privy to. In other words, you're so close that you get all the secrets. To be sure. And here's the great one. It also means to cohabit. Adam knows Eve and conceives a son. Cain knows his wife and conceives a son. Knowing in the Hebrew meant sexual intercourse. So you've got all of this idea of knowing. The common thread is to know, is to be as intimate as you can possibly be for a long period of time. That's knowing in Hebrew. So literally what God is asking us to do is to take him into our tent and know him. Make sure the tent's not stolen. And know him. So, how do we live so that God knows us and we know God? In the first century, there were four main groups. And Josephus tells about them. There were the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Essenes, and the Zealots. Four major political and religious groups. Each one of them dealt with their situation in a different way. The Jews were a minority, opposition little group, facing the overwhelming force of the Roman Empire. So if you're an opposition group, like the Democrats in Congress right now, they're an opposition group, how are they going to deal with the majority? How did the Jews deal with the majority of the Romans? Well, the Sadducees became completely aligned with Roman power. And they were the ones who were running the temple, and they were the ones who were calling the shots in the Sanhedrin. They, in a sense, became the system. That was their way of dealing with it. The Pharisees were different. The Pharisees opposed the Romans. The Pharisees did not have all the trappings of power that the Sanhedrin did. But what they tried to do was work within the system to influence it, to get their own points of view across. So instead of becoming the system, they tried to work within the system. Then you had the Zealots. The Zealots wanted to destroy the system. They were the revolutionaries. They were committing the assassinations and they were trying to destroy. And then you had the Essenes. And what did the Essenes do? They exited the system. They said, basically, a pox on all your houses, we are out of here. And they're the ones who went to the Dead Sea and developed communities like Qumran, which gave us the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, if you think about it, those are the four choices that you have when you're dealing with an overwhelming force. You can become aligned with it, become the system. You can try to work within the system. You can try to overthrow the system. Or you can get the heck out of Dodge. You got those four choices, basically, and what else do you have? You know, and when you think about it today, we've got Christians who are doing all of those. If you're going to become the system, well, isn't that the Christian Exodus's choice right now? They're going to all move to North Carolina, and they're going to become the system. It's going to become a Democrat or a Christian state, and all the judges and all the legislators and the governor and the state house, it's all going to be Christian. That's what they want to do. They want to become it. Who are those who want to work within the system? Well, we just talked about Jerry Falwell and his group. They want to get into places of power and influence. They want to work with the system. Same thing with Pat Robertson, who wanted to be president in the late 80s, and Dobson, James Dobson, who was trying to influence legislature. They're trying to work within the system. And then you've got those who want to destroy the system. Think about our abortion terrorists, Christian abortion terrorists, who are killing doctors and blowing up abortion clinics. And then you've got the separatists, don't you? The ones that go off into Idaho and Montana. And these two, yeah. Who want to exit the system. The Winnebagans. All right, here's the key. What was Jesus' way? What did he do? What Jesus gave us was a fifth way. Jesus did not deal with the system per se, but he didn't exit it either, did he? He worked within the system in the sense that he still stayed in community with people, but he never would deal with the system either. And when that mantle of power was trying to put on him by the zealots, and he said, no, my kingdom's not of this world. And when people came to him and asked him political questions, he said, render to Caesar that which is Caesar, but to God which is God's. And he always stayed on the other side of that line, and he was giving us a fifth way of dealing with things. And that way is dealing with individual people and not with a system. In other words, he was trying to get the frame of reference, the worldview change from a macro to a micro. We're not going to deal with this whole system. That's overwhelming. How are you going to overthrow the Romans? And the Jews tried twice and ended up completely wiped out and banned from Judea for 2,000 years, 1,900 years. But Jesus had a different way. Not obsessed with changing systems, but changing hearts one by one. I want to read you a little story that also hit me this last week. This is by Charles Krauthammer. He says, place, Los Angeles area emergency room, time, various times over the last 18 years. Scene, white male around 50 brought in by ambulance, pale, short of breath, in distress. The intern says, you're going to be all right, sir. I'm replacing your fluids and your blood studies and electrolytes should be back from the lab in just a few minutes. The patient says, son, you wait for my electrolytes to come back and I'll be dead in 10 minutes. I ran the ICU here for 10 years. I'm a pan-hypopit and in circulatory shock. I need 300 milligrams of hydrocortisone right now, in a bolus, right now. After that, I'll tell you what to run into my IV and what lab test to run. Got it? Intern, yes, sir. This scene played itself at least half a dozen times. The patient was my brother, Marcel. He later called to regale me with the whole play-by-play, punctuated with innumerable, incredulous, can you believe it's. We laughed. I loved hearing that mixture of pride and defiance in his voice as he told me how he had yet again thought and talked his way past death. Amazingly, he always got it right. True, he was a brilliant doctor, a UCLA professor of medicine, and a pulmonologist of unusual skill. But these diagnostic feats were performed lying flat on his back, near delirious, and on the edge of circulatory collapse. Marcel instantly knew why. It was his cancer returning, the rare tumor he'd been carrying since 1988, suddenly popping up in some new life-threatening anatomical location. By the time he got to the ER and was looking up at the raw young intern, he'd figured out where it was and what to do. I loved hearing these tales in part because it brought out the old bravado in him, the same courage that in the 1980s, when AIDS was largely unknown and invariably fatal, led Marcel to bronchoscope patients with active disease. At that time, not every doctor was willing to risk being on the receiving end of the coughing and spitting up. Be careful, Mars, I would tell him, and he'd laugh. Friends and colleagues knew this part of Marcel, the headstrong cowboy, far better than I did. We hadn't lived in the same city since he went off to medical school when I was 17. What I knew they didn't, however, was the Marcel of before, the golden youth of our childhood together. He was 4 years older and a magnificent athlete, good ball player, great sailor, and the most elegant skier I'd ever seen. But he was generous with his gifts. He taught me most everything I ever learned about every sport I ever played. He taught me how to throw a football, hit a backhand, grip a nine iron, field a grounder, dock a sailboat in a tailing wind. He was even more generous still. Whenever I think back to my childhood friends, Morgie, Fiedler, Clipper, the Beller Boys, I realize that they were not my contemporaries, but his. And when you're young, 4 years is a chasm. But everyone knew Marcel's rule, Charlie plays. The corollary was understood. If Charlie doesn't play, Marcel doesn't play. I played. From the youngest age, he taught me to go one-on-one with the big boys, a rare and priceless gift. And how we played. Spring came late when we grew up in Canada. But every year, our father would take us out of school early to have a full 3 months of summer at our little cottage in the seaside town of Long Beach, New York. For those 3 months of endless summer, Marcel and I were inseparable. Vagabond brothers shuttling endlessly on our Schwinns from beach to beach and ball game to ball game. Day and night we played, every sport ever invented. And some games, like three-step stoop ball and sidewalk Spalding, we just made up ourselves. For a couple of summers, we even wangled ourselves jobs teaching sailing at Treasure Island, the aptly named day camp nearby. It was paradise. There's a black and white photograph of us, two boys alone. He's maybe 11, I'm 7. We're sitting on a jetty, those jutting piles of rock that little beach towns throw down at half-mile intervals to hold back the sea. In the photo, nothing but sand, sea, and sky, the pure elements of our summers together. We were both thin as rails, tanned to blackness, and dressed in our summer finest, bathing suits and buzz cuts. Marcel's left arm is draped around my neck with that effortless, natural easefulness and touch of protectiveness that only older brothers know. Whenever I look at that picture, I know what we were thinking at the moment it was taken. It will be forever thus, ever brothers, ever young, ever summer. My brother Marcel died on Tuesday, January 17th. It was winter, he was 59. I get choked up because I was thinking about this, and I didn't have a Marcel in my life. I didn't have someone I could really go to like that, someone who put their arm around me. Barb and I had parents that were wonderful parents, but they're kind of distant. You know, they didn't really connect with us in the same way. And I didn't have an older brother, and I really didn't have a mentor in my life. And that's why I made a lot of really stupid choices. You know, talking about the imprinting you get by the time you're 7 years old, to have someone in your life like Marcel can make all the difference in the world. Here, Charles Krauthammer is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist. His brother, Marcel, was a UCLA graduate and a celebrated pulmonologist. They had a start in life because of their connection with each other and possibly their parents too, that gave them a foundation on which to walk. This is the fifth way. This is what Jesus is talking about. If we can stop thinking about the macro, if we can stop thinking about everything out there, if we can stop thinking about the world as a depraved place that somehow we need to change and win back for Christ, and we can see the eyeballs that are right in front of us, and we can drape an arm around that neck, and we can be there for that person, the system can change, but it's not going to change tomorrow. But it's going to change slowly. It's going to change from the ground up, and it's not going to change from the top down. There are three things about Jesus' way that I wanted to share with you all this morning. The first one is that we need to get small. We need to change our worldview from the macro to the micro. We've got to stop thinking about building great empires and building great corporations, and we've got to start thinking about one person. Just talking to people, building relationships. You know, we always want to go in and fix something. We see something wrong with a person, you just want to go and give them the solution and then go on to the next person, kind of like triage in an ER or something. What does that do for a person, really? Someone came to me and said that they wanted to work with their nephew. And he read all these books that he'd never heard of. How can I reach this kid? I said, well, what does he like to do? Well, he likes to read all these weird books. I said, read one of those books. Read a book that he has read, and then ask him questions about it. Find out what he thinks of this book. See if you like it or don't like it, and talk to him about it. We've got to create a common ground with each other. If we're coming from different worldviews, and make no mistake, our young people are in a different worldview than we baby boomers. If we want to really build a relationship with them, we have to enter their world. Jesus met everyone at their point of need, not where they should be, not where he wanted them to be. He met them where they were, and he went from there. We need to establish common ground. We need to establish a relationship. The people are important, not the system. people within the system can be whatever they can conceive to be in God. And we can help that. We can affect that. And I think our effectiveness is inversely proportional to the amount of people we're dealing with. You got that? In other words, the greater the number of people we're dealing with, the less our effectiveness. As we move that group smaller and smaller, our effectiveness goes up, and it's at maximum when we're one-on-one. That's what Charlie needed. He needed Marcel in his life. We all need a Marcel in our life. We need to be that person. Get small. Second thing, get personal. We need to build those relationships and take the time to do it. There's no fast cure here. It took us 20, 30 years to get all these knots tied in our rope. We're not going to do it in a day. You guys know, again, from AA, it doesn't happen overnight. You work the 12 steps, and you work them, and you work them, and you work them, and then you fall off the wagon, and then you have to get back on again and start over. And it's the way it is. It's going to take time. We need the relationships as a foundation to really know the other person. And that's knowing the Hebrew sense again, isn't it? We need to be able to feel that person in our grasp because we know them so well. So we need to get personal. And then we need to get practical. We talked about practicality and what all that means. We need to give concrete help to a concrete need. One of the worst things you can do for someone in distress is to give them some abstract platitude. It doesn't even relate necessarily to what they're going through. And even if it sort of does, what good is it? You need to know them well enough to know what it is going on in their life so that you can give them something they can use right here, right now, in this moment, something that helps. And sometimes it's not words at all. What word do you give to someone who's just lost their father or their mother or a child? What can you say? You can think of all these wonderful theological things to say, but I'm telling you, it ain't going to help. The only thing you can sometimes do is drape your arm around their neck and just be with them and just share the pain with them and go through that with them so that you know them that much better and you shared. There's nothing to say. It's just what you do. It's so important. I don't know if any of you took any public speaking classes or training. And sometimes they tell you to look at the back of the room so that it looks like you're covering the room with your gaze. Did you ever hear that one? I'm telling you right now, that's bunk. Don't do it. What you do is you look at one person in the eyes as you're speaking with them. Because then that whole group thinks you're looking at them. But you are talking to one person and you're seeing them. I remember when I was on stage with other people, they told us, make eye contact with one person and you'll have that person for the rest of the performance. And you know what? It was true. If I was at the front line and I looked at one person, any time I looked back at that person, they were always looking at me. You make a contact and they don't forget it. If you ever did radio, what do they tell you to do? They tell you don't just speak into a microphone and think about how many people might be listening. You picture one person that you know in your mind and you talk to that person. Because then everybody who hears you hears the intimacy of your voice. This is what we need to learn. This is Jesus' fifth way. You get small, you get personal, and because you have that relationship, then you can get practical. If we can work that way with each other, we can build a grassroots foundation that can eventually overthrow a system. And that's what the kingdom, the millennium, is in the future. It's the kingdom of the heart, the kingdom within, that becomes manifested without, because we hit that critical mass and it turns everything over. So how does God know us? That's how He's going to know us. By the relationships that we have with each other. Because He said, that which you do to the least of these, you do to Me. We love God, we know God by knowing each other. We need to do that. How can we make 2006 better? We can start knowing people. Really knowing them. Seeing them. Every contact that we make, no matter how incidental it may seem. And I've used this example, honey, a couple of times now. Marion was telling me that she came home from work. This is when we were first married and we were living in Irvine. And she had just had the worst day. She cried all the way home. And she had to sit in the carport for a few minutes to get composed. And so she could just walk back to the apartment. And when she did, she's coming up the walkway. And one of our neighbors that we didn't even know very well came around the corner and just gave her one of those huge electric smiles that came from her toes and had just genuineness written all over it. And it changed everything for Mary. changed everything for her. She was able to continue on in a different life from that moment on. Each contact we have is a moment that can be a kingdom moment if we connect with the other. Those moments string together and they actually take us someplace good. That's how we're going to make this year better. If we can see each person, each contact in that way, when we're driving in this incredibly beautiful place in Orange County, if we see that beauty and we recognize it for what it is and take a moment to thank God for the beautiful place that we live. We look in our child's eyes. We hold our pet dog or whatever. You know, every moment is a moment of connection, potential connection. That's the fifth way. That's what Jesus is asking us to do. Because in that, seeking first the kingdom, everything else is added. Stop thinking about the sins in your life. Stop thinking about all the junk that you have left undone. Stop thinking about how terrible the world is and how it needs to be changed and how our nation needs to be changed so that God won't visit some horrible judgment on us. None of that gets you anywhere. Like begets like. Fear begets fear. Anger begets anger. And love begets love. We need to focus on those things that Jesus showed us and let it displace all the rest. And then we're going to get to that joyful celebratory place and our year is going to get better. So I just encourage you all to think about that. With every pair of eyes you lay eyes on, think that this is a moment where you can connect and something really spectacular can happen.